Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston C.A. For more than three decades, Congressman Dan Rostenkowski of Illinois both represented his district and symbolized a political style that has now passed from the scene. Like the city of big shoulders of his birth and breeding, his was a forceful presence, and his political philosophy was rooted in traditional loyalties. Although his career would end in adversity, he remains, by any objective account, a towering figure in the annals of 20th century American political life. My guest is Richard Cohen, author of a new biography of Daniel Rostenkowski. Richard, welcome to Dialogue.
Good to be with you.
Richard, I enjoyed the book, and I think you'd agree that a careful reader can come up with his or her own reasons why a biography was written. And in this case, the rise and fall of a powerful figure is theme enough in itself. But I think the more interesting question is why you, as journalist and biographer, chose this man and this subject.
Well, fair question. I've been reporting on Congress for more than 20 years for National Journal magazine here in Washington, and we are, as some of your listeners no doubt know, we are a nonpartisan magazine reporting a fair amount of depth for a fairly intensive, for people who follow Washington fairly intensively, and I've had a desire over the years to perhaps write for a broader audience on broader themes, and also had a desire, especially after the Democrats lost control of Congress in 1994, I felt that there was a real place for a book kind of looking back on that extraordinary 40-year period in which Democrats controlled Congress. And frankly, a publisher came to me with a similar idea and suggested, why not focus on the life of Dan Rostenkowski, who is someone who, as a reporter on Congress, I dealt very closely with. Mm-hmm. So kind of this series of factors, he was willing to cooperate with me, although the book has been under my control. It is not an authorized biography.
Yeah. You know, in that answer, you suggest to me that both you and your publisher saw in this man very much a symbol of that 40-year dominance of Congress by the Democratic Party, as a man who sort of represented that particular kind of powerful fact.
He's a symbol in any number of respects. He produced, I believe, more than any member of the House during that 40-year period. He was involved in more legislative efforts and taking an active role in issues ranging and legislative fights ranging from Medicare under Lyndon Johnson, President Johnson, and the Great Society, all the way from Medicare to President Clinton's failed effort to have health reform. But he not only is he a symbol of legislative efforts, but he's a symbol. He's a useful paradigm is a word that some use. Looking at Rostenkowski is a good way of looking at the changes that took place within Congress during his 36 years in the House.
Is that because, Richard, one is tempted to think of him as kind of a big city urban machine politician with all the swagger that implies and the sort of favors done that suggests?
And he was, and that's absolutely true. And when he came to Congress in 1959, there were a lot of big city urban machine Democrats. Mm-hmm. By the time he left Congress in 1994 under less auspicious circumstances, there were relatively few of that old style urban machine Democrats. The cities changed in ways that we can talk about if you'd like. And the Democratic Party changed and Congress changed. To some extent, Rostenkowski remained what he was. He didn't change, but he adapted to the institution, and that helps to explain his successes, to some extent his failures and his problems. But I think his life is therefore an interesting way of not only looking at his life, not only helps us to understand him, but to some extent understand Congress during that period.
There's a marvelous quote almost at the very end of the book of Congressman Dennis Eckhart, who very colorfully, perhaps aptly, says, "The road curved, but he kept driving straight." And is that, in essence, the essence of the Rostenkowski story, that he was sort of faithful to a style of politics that went out of fashion?
And that applied, yes, and that applies in at least a couple of ways. One, his view of legislation, his view of public policy remained fairly steady even while politics in America were changing. He was a kind of a good, solid what we call urban Democrat, meat and potato Democrats, Democrat who believe that government played a role, particularly in broad ways, helping people through Social Security, Medicare, health care reform, broad issues. But he didn't think the government, reflecting kind of the Mayor Daley, Richard J. Daley view of politics, he felt that government to some extent, should be kept at the local level. And he was somewhat reluctant to have a major federal presence in all aspects of life. So,
is he an exemplar of Tip O'Neill's adage? All politics.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. The other, going back to the quote you cited from Dennis Eckert, the road curved, but he kept going straight. That certainly applies to Rostenkowski's view of Congress and ethics and standards for politicians. Mm-hmm. There were shifting standards. Mm-hmm. He kept to the old ones.
This is a man who's probably very well understood by understanding his roots. And, of course, that means Chicago. That means what it means to be a Polish-American politician in Chicago, Polonia, that's the New World Polish-American community, St. Stanislaus Kosta Church. I mean, these institutions seem to me to be very much a part of the man throughout his political career.
The Polish community was the largest ethnic community in Chicago when Dan Rostenkowski grew up. It also was the poorest. And I describe it in some length, as you know. What's interesting is that the Polish community, despite its size, never really had the political power mm-hmm. in Chicago.
You say in the book it was riven by factions.
Yeah, and they suffered in part from lack of income. They suffered from factionalism, as you said. They also suffered because they from some language problems, and just the Irish and the Italian communities were more, and some of the Eastern European communities were more effective, more skillful within a city politics, within the church of the city. So Rostenkowski was one of the leaders of the leading polls in Chicago, but he decided to play out and to exercise his power within the larger community and the party.
Yeah, because I think it's a very good point. It's made in the book that although he was certainly proud of his roots, certainly proud of his ethnic heritage, he didn't strike me as being, quote, the traditional ethnic politician at every stage of his career.
And he wasn't embarrassed by being Polish, but he wanted to, became part of the melting pot, and he was comfortable and in the Democratic Party, and the Democratic Party of Chicago appealed, made itself kind of the big family, the big tent.
We're going to discuss his work when he becomes chairman of Ways and Means in just a moment and other aspects of the man, but maybe it's appropriate now, Richard, given that your book is fruit of some very direct personal interviews with him and contacts, as well as observing him for many years. What are the essential qualities of Dan Rostenkowski, both the things that helped him get to the top and the things that might have pushed him over the other side?
Well, I like to say, and I wrote, that he's kind of big, he's gruff, he's very direct, and he kind of reminds me of a Chicago Bears linebacker. He's not by any means an intellectual, but he's someone who's a quick study. And he has his basic strength is that he has a good political instinct, and he has great self-confidence. When he was in government, he had the confidence to act on his confidence. I mean, he didn't always win. He didn't always perhaps do the right thing, but he just kind of moved ahead day by day.
You know, one of the qualities that I sensed, in addition to the ones you just cited, is consistency. Because this image of the big, very confident figure comes very strongly to the book. But such a person, and maybe I'm engaging in pop psychology here, though, tends to hew to a certain course.
Right.
And that, to put a fine point on it, I felt that he was perhaps astounded by his later ethical troubles, because he, I think, honestly saw himself as simply being true to a pattern of political conduct that he'd been raised in.
He felt that he was true to that conduct. He could not understand why the rules needed to be changed. He felt that if other politicians wanted to live by other standards, that's fine. Mm-hmm. He felt that the standards that he was brought up in and that guided his life, the standards, if you will, of Chicago, were fine, and that was good enough for him. And besides which, you know, the rules were changing so often that he said he couldn't keep track of them and still do his job as particularly as chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. So he got caught in a vice of in which he was trying to be true to what he felt was good public policy and good ethical behavior. But meanwhile, things were changing from underneath him.
We're going to talk about how those things changed and why in just a moment. Let me take a moment from our conversation to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest is Richard Cohen, author of Rostenkowski, The Pursuit of Power and the End of the Old Politics, published by Ivan R. D. Press. Rostenkowski, as chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, the successor to Wilbur Mills. Let's talk first about what he accomplishes with that committee, Richard. I mean, just viewed as a legislative record, the 13-year tenure, which in itself I think is pretty outstanding. But what kinds of legislation is he identified with?
I think the bill that he was the proudest of was the Tax Reform Act of 1986, which President Ronald Reagan proposed, and Rostenkowski basically represented the Democratic Party in making the core decision to cooperate with the then quite popular Ronald Reagan to reform the tax code, which had become a mess. And frankly, the tax code Rostenkowski and Reagan worked together in 1986 to simplify the code, and I think unfortunately it has become more complex since 1986. We'd all be better if they went back to the tax reform of 86. I think that was his most important accomplishment, and it was kind of the prototypical Rostenkowski effort of consensus building, of bipartisanship. There were other important laws and issues that he dealt with, Social Security reform, which was enacted in 1983, which is when he and Reagan and others got involved in this, and it's a more complex story than we could talk about here. But Social Security was on the verge of the trust fund was going bankrupt in the early 80s. And there was something of a crisis. And again, there was a bipartisan effort that he was part of to rescue Social Security. And it's now in much better shape. That reform has stood the test of time, even though there are now, again, efforts and discussions on the way to reform. Another area that he was involved in, but he'd be the first to say he regrets that there wasn't more done, was healthcare reform. And he led what became a very controversial effort, again with President Reagan, to enact in 1988 what was called the Catastrophic Care Reform Bill to provide coverage for senior citizens who had a lot of healthcare bills. And that was enacted. President Reagan gladly signed it in 1988, but it ultimately was repealed in 1989 because a small group of senior citizens groups, encouraged by some political forces here in Washington, mounted a lobbying campaign against the bill. Rostenkowski thought it was crazy, but most other members of Congress decided to buckle, and they ultimately repealed the law. He also, just very briefly, was very active on international trade issues. He was a free trader, both because that was a good thing to do in Chicago, and I think he felt it was good for the country. He was active on welfare and child care issues, again, from a more of a centrist perspective.
But even as he's doing all these things, and it is an extraordinarily productive record, the sands are shifting and things are changing around him, and waves of reform are taking place in terms of the very membership of the House. I think as early as 1974, with I guess the Watergate generation coming in, young reform politicians, Democrats in a large part, are becoming to be more and more a factor, and that's a problem for him, isn't it?
That was 1974 was really kind of the break point. It's the way in which I divide the Democratic era in half, and it produced the election of a lot of kind of what I call new breed Democrats. They're kind of the opposite of the old Rostenkowski's urban machine Democrats. And they were just these new breed Democrats were very different than Rostenkowski. They were brought up on television. They were more comfortable with television. They were less committed, less devoted to a local political party. They were more entrepreneurial in all these respects. They were just kind of 180 degrees opposite from Rostenkowski. And he had trouble with them initially. But again, what happened over time is they adapted to him. He adapted to them. And in 1976, he supported in a kind of a crucial contest for power in the House of Representatives. Rostenkowski backed Jim Wright of Texas to be the majority leader under Speaker Tip O'Neill. Mm-hmm. Jim Wright won by basically by one vote. That brought Rostenkowski back into favor within the House. Mm-hmm. 4 years later, as you know, Rostenkowski became chairman of the Ways and Means Committee when Ronald Reagan was president, became president. And he with his background in the Democratic Party with 22 years in the House, he became a quite an effective chairman.
At the very height of Dan Rostenkowski's power, influence, and visibility, he becomes a national figure. I mean, I guess you would be as chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee anyway, but I'm speaking now at that point where he's issuing the Rostenkowski challenge on the budget, and he's he himself is seen on television and is asking voters to ask Rosty or to mail in their reactions to him and to give him support and so forth. How does that transition, how did that moment work? I mean, was that really an effective moment of transition for him as into a national figure?
Well, he was never comfortable with television. I mean, he's adapted himself. He actually now makes occasional appearances in Chicago as a political commentator for one of the stations. But he's he adapted to the new political demands without really embracing them. Mm-hmm. And so that, for example, in 1990, when he also saw that there were problems in public policy, specifically the federal budget deficit, and it seems extraordinary to think now when we're having budget surpluses. Well, back in 1990, the deficit was at $200 and $300 billion. Mm-hmm. Rostenkowski thought it was crazy. He also, frankly, felt a little bit of responsibility for it because of the tax cut bill that he was unable to stop, Reagan's tax cut in 1981. So come 1990, the two parties, Democrats controlled Congress, Republican George Bush, Rostenkowski's friend, they controlled the White House, and Rostenkowski was frustrated because problems, especially the budget deficit, weren't being addressed, and he issued what you described as the Rostenkowski challenge, mm-hmm. and he took upon himself ways of getting around the roadblocks in politics and the way Washington was working to try to force attention to that issue. And just very briefly, it led to in a convoluted way, the Rostenkowski challenge led to months of negotiations at Andrews Air Force Base, at the White House, and ultimately the enactment of a major deficit reduction budget package, which I think put the country on the road to balancing the budget where we are now.
I think many would agree with that. It is ironic, though, that even as he was doing that, this might have been the period in which his emergence at this level of national import was also creating something of a distance between him and Chicago. That is to say, I got the sense that those old constituents were beginning to wonder if Danny Rostenkowski had gotten too big for his precinct.
And that's right. And in part, it's because even though he would go home, continue to fly back to Chicago every weekend, sometimes he would go to his vacation home up in Wisconsin, or he would just kind of stay at his home near downtown Chicago. And even though he was at home, the community had changed around him. Yeah. And Rostenkowski stayed in touch with the power brokers, but he kind of lost interest, frankly, mm-hmm. in kind of dealing with the guy in the street. He was partly because he was too busy mm-hmm. being chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. And there was a tension that grew up. If he was going to do the work of Ways and Means Committee chairman, he had less time to tend to local political matters. And there was a second factor at play, which I'm sure you recall from the book, which really struck me as interesting and something that hadn't occurred to me in my years of reporting on Rostenkowski, which was that in Chicago, people there didn't understand how important he was in Washington. And at the very same time in Washington, people here didn't understand how important it was for us, it was to Rostenkowski to be active in local Chicago politics. There was, I like to say, I wrote that there was a disconnect between these two phases of his life at Chicago and Washington, and very few people understood the way in which he operated in the two venues.
Of course, he compartmentalized himself an awful lot, didn't he?
Yes.
I mean, and his staffs, I mean, it was fascinating to note at one point that the Washington staff might have been doing, it was doing things that the Chicago staff didn't necessarily know about, and vice versa.
To some, but he, in compartmentalizing it, he was the one who allowed that to happen. He wanted to keep these two parts of his life separate.
Yeah.
I can't fully explain why, but it did cause him some problems.
Well, as a great drama, and this is a great drama, we've probably reached the point at which things, the balance begins to shift a bit. And there's an enormous point of irony here, because by 1992, in 1992 to be precise, when he was thinking about retirement, had Congressman Rostenkowski chosen to retire, the final bitter chapters probably would never have taken place.
I agree.
That is to say, the political defeat, he lost office in
1994.
The political scandals, one of which would envelop him directly, and of course ultimately incarceration. Why did he persist?
That's a good question. He probably asked himself that very question himself these days. I think there was there were a number of reasons, I think. He did think very seriously about leaving in 1992, but George Bush, who was Dan Rostenkowski's good friend from when they served on the Ways and Means Committee as young members in the 1960s, President George Bush in 1991-92 convinced Rostenkowski that they should both stay around for a few more years and address problems of Social Security, of Medicare, of the budget. That was one factor that played to Rostenkowski's ego. He also, I think he was a little bit, and this was a pattern throughout his life, he was uncertain about doing something new. He was a creature of habit. He liked being a member of Congress. He was reluctant to give up the robes. And he also, this is a bit of a technical detail, but it played a role. If he had left in 1992, the federal law would have permitted him to take all the money, legally, to take with him $1 million in his campaign treasury. He felt he would have been criticized for that. After 1992, members no longer were able to take that money with them. So he stayed here, and he used that money ultimately to pay for a lot of legal bills.
Yeah, and in the event, there were two scandals sort of in rapid succession. One was the house banking scandal. The one that he got caught up in was the post office scandal. He ends up pleading guilty, I think, to two sort of relatively petty charges.
The investigation began in 1992 by the federal prosecutor here in Washington. The U.S. and the U.S. Attorney of District of Columbia brought the indictment in June of 1994. It was 17 counts. It featured the so-called stamps for cash scandal at the House Post Office. But when Rostenkowski ultimately pleaded guilty 2 years later in 1996, he was by this time out of Congress, the plea bargain resulted in the stamps for cash, the post office charges being thrown out. And as you say correctly, he pleaded guilty to two what really stand as relatively minor offenses. Rostenkowski acknowledged that he broke the law, but he says, it's for others to judge how serious they are. He says these were the kind of offenses that politicians and often engage in. And very briefly, they were payroll padding. He put mostly young people, in most cases, young people on his payroll for, you know, college kids for a summer job, stuff like that. And he acknowledged they didn't do a whole lot of work. That's number one. And number two, he pleaded guilty to making purchases at the House stationery store and using those purchases for personal purposes rather than official, for giving gifts to friends.
There's a novelistic quality about the concluding chapters. I mean, everything from the attitude of the judge who sentenced him to his own reactions to all of this, and I got the impression he was, and may still be, bemused by all of this, in the sense that, insofar as the employment things were considered, hell, everybody did it. I mean,
right,
would might be a reasonable attitude for him to take. And as to the purchases, that revolved around 60 chairs or something like that,
and a few crystal sculptures.
Yeah,
and for a fireplace mantle.
That's right. And he said, well, what were they there for if not to buy?
And because they were, they were purchases that lots of members made at the post office. And Rostenkowski made one of the larger points here is, Rostenkowski made the point, and frankly, Bill Clinton made it a couple of years later that once a federal prosecutor puts his teeth into a target, it's hard for the target to, it's, you know, very few politicians, frankly, maybe very few people around the country could escape 100% pure. And clearly, Rostenkowski committed some offenses, and the prosecutor decided to go through with it.
This trial, its result, the conviction, the incarceration, are like a very fitting punctuation point, perhaps, to the end of an era. Do you see it that way, Richard?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the, as I say in the beginning of the book, the trial, and the indictment, and the ultimate plea bargain that sent Rostenkowski to a federal prison for about a year and a half, marked the end of an era of politics, and certainly his life in politics, but it was the end of the Democratic era in Congress. And no doubt Democrats will someday win back the majority, but it's taken them longer than they thought would be the case. And I think Rostenkowski symbolized an era which really is over now.
To conclude our conversation, Richard, is there a meaning or a moral we can attach to this rather extraordinary story?
Well, I think Dan Rostenkowski, I don't want to glorify him. And, you know, as I said, I wrote about him warts and all, but I think he is he's a good example of 20th century American politics, both because of the Chicago roots and the importance of Chicago to his life and the importance of cities to American life. But he's also the kind of, you know, he's a third generation American who worked hard, and not a lot of, not deep intelligence, but he got the most out of it. He worked hard and got a lot out of his life and had great power. And then ultimately, after prison, returned to his community, and that's where he sits now. I mean, he showed, in some sense, the common man quality of American life and American politics in the 20th century.
This is an American story.
Absolutely.
Richard Cohen, it's a great book.
Thank you.
Thank you for being with us today on Dialogue.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Richard Cohen, author of a new biography of Daniel Rostenkowski. I'm George Liston, CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Reed, our technical director is John Tyler, and production assistant is Kirsten LaCour-DeBelco. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For cassettes or more information on Dialogue, call us at 303-823-8000. Contact us on America Online at Radio Dial. That's RADIODIAL at AOL.com. Visit our internet webpage at wwics.si.edu.